Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, hello. It's time to labyrinth. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret, your host, and I'm just pleased to welcome you on this beautiful evening of, where are we? I am telling you, it's been going so fast, I cannot even begin to think that we're in August, almost the end of August. Today's August 25th. 2010, and I know that this show is going to be archived, so I always like to tell the date because I have visions of perhaps people who have a passion for history like I do coming by long after this host is on our way to Never Never Land and listening to some of these very exciting and interesting stories about Jamaica, land we love. Because for those who might not know, Margaret Marshall was born and raised in Jamaica, but I left Jamaica from 1959. And I have wonderful memories of growing up on that beautiful island. So today I'm going to ask you, like I always do, to, if you've visited or you are there, or you were born there and remember those balmy breezes that the trade winds, I think they were called, as they come across the island in the evening. I can't remember what time it was, but oh my gosh, it was just so relaxing with just feeling the wind across your face. So we're going to pretend we're there no matter how hot it is where you are or no matter what the weather. Because in Jamaica, we always say, no problem, man. So I want to welcome you to this segment of Backyard Labrish. And today, we have a very exciting evening to learn something about our history as an island and the important part we have played in, I would almost call it the world order, not the new world order now, because that, I suppose, is still in the making. But, you know, as a tiny island, we have contributed so many different things in so many different ways by so many different people. Some that were born and raised in Jamaica, some that came from another country to Jamaica, one way or another, whether as slaves or as indentured servants, or just came as merchants or opportunity seekers. I mean, we've had some fabulous stories on the Labrish, and I hope if you're a regular fan that you will check some of those that you might not have heard yet. And, you know, you can just, all the shows are archived. If you go to the Blog Talk website, if you're listening online, you will see, if you go by month, you can select any show that you want to hear. And we always ask you to share. If it's information that has tweaked your interest and you have friends or relatives, no matter where they are, you can send them the link. Just copy and paste the link from your browser, or better yet, go to our website and let us know that you were there and give us a suggestion as what you would like us to talk about. Because here on the Labrish, we like to include our fans, and, you know, we want to hear your voice and to hear your stories. So today, if you are on my list, you will know that this is an enlightening evening. We're going to talk about something that I'm not sure, but I think very few people know. And the material I'm sharing today is from a wonderful book, The Encyclopedia of Jamaican Heritage, by Olive Senior, and some of the information I also collected from Pieces of the Past, which is from the Jamaican Gleaner, which is online. And I really encourage people in the diaspora to really get interested in the history. We have such a rich, diverse history. It's just fun to find out about it. So I am going to read first from some information I got from Pieces of the Past. Now, Jamaica's participation in Europe's war was nothing new. Oh, apparently they had something before this. Now, the Caribbean waters were not a main battleground. Oh, they're talking about a special war. So let me start somewhere else. Now, the historical connection with Jamaicans began in 1600 when the first militia regiments were formed after the island was captured by Cromwell's English troop in 1662. The state of Jamaica under Sir Thomas Lynch, which was in 1883, includes the following description. The militia in this island is better armed and much better disciplined than in England, and do much more duty as waiting on the governors, guarding the forts, especially at Port Royal, where there are 10 companies of about 200 each, one of which watched every night. Now, all the militia is commanded by the governor as chaplain general, according to his magistrate's power and the act of the militia. There's 8 regiments in the 8 provinces and a troop of horse in every province. Every man between the age of 15 and 60 had to enlist and remain enlisted in the foot or horse and provide his own horse and ammunition, each in the place of his abode. Now, in those days, I suppose, they wrote in what we called Old English. So it doesn't even sound right. That means house or place of residence, I suppose, in today's language. But the place of his abode. Now, you can imagine these people are serving in a regiment. They have to provide their own horse and their own ammunition. Well, I'm telling you. Now, go back to the article. Except for a small artillery element manning harbor fortification, the militia was disbanded in 1906 under the belief that their services would not be needed since the world was at peace and the population of the West Indies could not possibly be of any consequence in any imaginable war of the near future. A reserve regiment took its place. So what we understand is that there was this regiment of foot and horse soldiers who guarded these various places like the forts and all of that. And they had to provide their own transportation and attack weapon, as in ammunition. Now, that was something that I never heard of. I was not familiar with this at all. Now, in November, we were talking now of 1683. And this was what I got from pieces of the past. Now, in November of 1915, Brigadier General Blackden sent off the first Jamaican contingent under the command of one Mr. Nish to serve in the First World War. Now, this was his speech to them. "Some of you may be killed," he cautioned. "Many will be wounded, but in bidding you farewell, I hope that those who fall may fall gloriously, their faces to the foe, victory gleaming on their bayonets," as the band played "Soldiers of the King," and prayers for their welfare and safe return home were said. 500 men sailed slowly off into the unknown, looking for adventure, a chance to serve God and country. The world had been at war for over a year. Well, I don't really think that a lot of Jamaicans know that we had soldiers in the First World War. I mean, I was really amazed. Now, I want to go now to the Encyclopedia of Jamaican History by Olive, I'm sorry. Now, I don't know if any of my listeners have ever heard of the West Indian Regiments. WIR was the acronym for them. But historic British regiments of black soldiers who were uniformed, armed, and trained along with European lines, originally formed for the defense of the British West Indies territories during the French and Napoleon Wars in the late 18th century and early 19th century, despite hostility to them by the colonial planters, class who dominated the island's assemblies, the soldiers proved themselves superior to British troops posted to the island, being much more adapted to the climate and with a far lower mortality rate. Throughout the 19th century, WIR, which is the West Indian Regiments, soldiers were employed on various campaigns in West Africa, including the Asiatic War. Their outstanding campaigns included Dominica in 1805, Martinique in 1809, Guadeloupe in 1810, West Africa in 1873. It just goes on. And Sierra Leone in 1898. Oh, my goodness. During operations in West Africa, two WIR soldiers won the highest military honor, the Victoria Cross, for bravery. One of them, a Jamaican, Sergeant W.J. Gordon. During the First World War, the WIR was posted to Cameroon during 1915 to 1916 and East Africa between 1916 to 1918. I was mesmerized when I was really so surprised because I had no idea that Jamaican-born and black, I suppose, ex-slaves or slaves were serving in those wars. Now, back to the encyclopedia. The WIR was finally disbanded in 1927 as an economic measure. In that year, the Jamaican Regiment was formed and no doubt included many who had served in the WIR. In January of 1959, the West Indian Regiment was reformed as part of the short-lived West Indian Federation, replacing the Jamaican Regiment that formed the nucleus of the new force, which recruited men from all the islands of the British West Indies. Now, when the Federation was dissolved in 1962, the Jamaica Defense Force was formed, consisting of the Jamaican Regiment and the Jamaican National Reserve. So that sort of gives our listeners a little history of how it evolved as it came down the pike. But I don't know for the rest of my listeners, but I had no idea we had people fighting for the crown in those years. So, you know, I even surprised my children with this, but during my years as I joined the British Army in Jamaica as Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps in 1952. So, you know, I was part of a small regiment of women who were taught to be nurses. We took care of the soldiers and families at Upper Camp in the 50s. So I knew of the Jamaica Battalion then. As a matter of fact, my husband, he became my husband afterward, but he was in the Jamaica Battalion in the 50s. So I suppose late 40s and early 50s. But even then, I had no idea, although I was part of the military myself, I had no idea that, you know, we had Jamaicans serving so early. I mean, I was really shocked. But there is one particular part of this whole story that I thought was so interesting to me. Because during the days of slavery, actual slavery, when the planters, the plantation owners, were purchasing slaves as they brought them in on the ships from Africa, the military people were also trying to find the fittest slaves and buying them to train them to be soldiers. And that is all documented. And I was really, so they never went to the plantation owners. They went right into military training. And there's interesting articles, really, you know, of how they were treated, you know, how they adapted. Of course, coming from Africa and coming to Jamaica, they would survive a lot better in that kind of climate than the English people or the Spanish or whoever, you know, that their native country didn't have the same kind of temperature. So it made sense that they would make better recruits. So she has a chapter here on African recruits, and I will read from it. The British Army at first hoped to secure enough recruits locally through the planters, but when this approach failed, they took to purchasing the fittest specimens arriving on the slave ships from Africa. And eventually, these African recruits were preferred over the Creole or Caribbean-born. By 1798, the WIR was almost entirely African. Even after the abolition of slavery in 1807, for a long time, free Africans continued continued to be recruited. Lady Nugent, wife of the governor of Jamaica in 1804, went to Port Augusta to see the new recruits and recorded in her journal. This was her, and I quote from her writing, "See the West Indian regiment out and all the new recruits. They made a most savage appearance, having only just arrived from Africa. All their names were written on cards tied around their necks. Like the other enslaved blacks, the new arrivals were given European names." Communication remained difficult. Not only did the new recruits have no English, they had a multiplicity of African languages among themselves because they were coming from different places, obviously. In the early days, a minimal effort was made to make them literate and teach them English. But somehow the army made itself understood. You know, even though they didn't read the language, I suppose, the poor slaves got the message. Out of such unpromising material came what all impartial observers regarded as excellent soldiers. The regiments were to win the highest praise from every commander under whom they served. You know, I get so much lessons as I read, you know, even things going back that far. Because in spite of the fact these people were, you know, came to wherever, to Jamaica, not of their free will. I mean, they were, I suppose, those that were recruited for the military might have had a little more freedom. I don't know. It was not really explained here. But my point is, even though they didn't communicate well and all of that, whatever they taught them, you know, how to defend, I'm sure that's what their role was. But whatever these English commanders taught them, they learned it very well. Even though they did not communicate verbally, they really understood to the point where they were commended by everyone that was in charge of them. And, you know, to me, that is just, there's so many lessons that we can learn even out of hardship, even out of hardship. And I am hoping that the younger generation, all of the world, but especially of Jamaicans, will learn some of this history and see how they need to really continue to excel in certain areas of their lives, because they have so much role models and so much really to be proud of, you know. And I'm really encouraging the older Jamaicans, the grandmothers and great grandmothers, to really not give up on the young folks. I think, you know, we miss the boat when we do that, because we have always been a strong people. That is the bottom line. And, of course, we're still excelling in a lot of areas, but there's so much more that we can do. And I think that whatever we can do to ignite some pride in our people, especially the young ones, to be proud of themselves and to contribute, do something, you know, no matter how the circumstances are, you can overcome if you really want to. There's all, once there's a will, there's a way. Because what I'm reading from these stories is, can you just put yourself in these recruits' position at the time? And here is a group of people. They don't even speak the same language. They're in bondage, you know, but perhaps they were drilling whatever they were drilling in their heads, and they got it. They got it. And they know they were there already, so they performed to the best of their ability. And even from what I read earlier, you can see they were all over the place, you know, in guarding the forts, doing this, doing that. But it is really amazing. Now, let me go back to Miss Senior's encyclopedia here, which I would recommend for every home, especially home with Jamaicans, Jabrits, or no matter what part of the world you may be residing or born, but you have some Jamaican heritage. We need to really research our roots and take pride in what we have accomplished. And really, there's so much to celebrate. So that's what we do here in the backyard. I must remind our listeners online that you're listening to Backyard Labrish. We're here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock to labrish about something of interest. And sometimes it's current events. Last week we interviewed a Canadian who wrote a wonderful book, Portland, the Other Jamaica. And that is a historical documentation on how Portland has evolved or was developed. And I think it's a marvelous book. And for the people of Portland, I think this book will make you proud. So it makes a great gift for one of your grandchildren or a friend or even someone that's not Jamaican but or has Jamaican heritage, but they might have a love of history, or they might just have a love for Jamaica, like we do. So let me go back to the encyclopedia and share some more with you. And by the way, please visit our website. And if any of our listeners on the board would like to join the Labrish and put their few cents in, do just hit 1 on your keypad on your telephone, so I will see a raised hand just like you were in school and you put your hand up. I see a little hand on my computer screen where I have my switchboard online. Oh, I just love this technology. And for the seniors who are afraid of the internet, I say, listen, go for it. There's nothing to be afraid of. It is not as challenging as it may seem at first, and it can be a lot of fun. And as I say, we are leaving a legacy. That's what we're doing when we share our stories in the backyard. Because, you know, it's archived in cyberspace, and your children, grandchildren, great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren can come by perhaps years after this and hear your voice and hear your idea or whatever. So if any of my listeners know of a senior, especially a senior, who would like to share their story with us in the backyard, do drop me a note and let me know, because I'd love to have them as a guest. And I encourage you to put your hand up and join the Labrish, because this is not a lecture, it's the Labrish. So let's go back to the encyclopedia. This next chapter is called First Freed Men. The social and legal status of these slaves in red coats, apparently that was the color of the uniform, as Roger Buckley calls them, was an ambiguous one. As he points out, within the walls of the British garrison, the West Indian soldier lived under conditions of military discipline, implying at least that he was a freed man. But no similar pronouncement covered him. Once he stepped beyond the gates of the post, in other words, he was free within the barracks, I suppose, but once he stepped out in the street, or apparently he couldn't. So let me go back to her. I put my sidebars in, you know, like these attorneys do. Sidebar! I mean, I'm entitled to do that, I think. And if any of you online want to have a sidebar, put your hand up, and I'll open up the mic and welcome you to the world. So here are these very disciplined soldiers that have been trained and commended and all of that for their, just how well they work at whatever they do. They're free within the barracks, but they're not free once they get out of the barracks. Okay, this legal problem was solved in 1807 when the British, by an act of Parliament, declared the soldier slave of the British West Indies to be a freed man. 26 years. See, a lot of people don't know this. I didn't know this. This was 26 years before the emancipation of the rest of the slaves. Now, if anybody online knew that, put your hand up, because I am just mesmerized by all of this information. According to Buckley, this affected about, are you ready for this, listeners? 10,000 soldiers. With Britain ending the slave trade in that year, recruits continued to come from Africa, but from among those liberated from slave ships of nations still engaged in the trade. So what happened then is that more people wanted to come, because other places they were still, you know, enslaved. When if you were in the military, you would be considered a freed man. So that was 26 years before the other slaves on the island was freed. Wow. That is so cool. That information, I just can't even tell you how enlightening that was for me. Anyway, with the end of the war in 1815 and the removal of a major threat to the West Indian security, 7 of the original 12 regiments were disbanded. By 1870, 3 more were disbanded. In 1887, the remaining 1st and 2nd were amalgamated as the 1st and 2nd Battalion of the West Indian Regiment. A 3rd battalion added in 1897 was disbanded in 1903, short-lived. The II was finally disbanded in 1927. I mentioned that from the Gleaner report. Now, during the First World War, the volunteer force that was raised in the West Indies to fight for Britain was known as the British West Indies Regiment and should not be confused with the historic West Indian Regiments. So the West Indian Regiments were an entity to themselves. Now, they were part of the, you know, the formation of the British West Indies Regiment, but it was not one on the same. So, as usual, I always, come on, callers, put your 2 cents in here, put your hands up. But I found that to be, number one, very educational, and secondly, I mean, very, to me, I had no clue. And I'm wondering why some of this was not taught under the British, you know, when we were colonial, and that's when I went to school in Jamaica. But I'm wondering if any of this history is being taught in the schools now, and what is the history curriculum like in the high schools or the elementary schools in Jamaica now, and if any of our listeners can enlighten me about that, because I have no clue. And I apologize all the time, but, you know, I don't really know much about, I call it the New Jamaica, because I left before independence. And I know that a lot has changed, and I am not up to date on everything that's going on educationally. I do check online sometimes and get some information that sometimes is not very encouraging, but I try to stay positive about it. But I don't know how any of my other listeners think, but I believe that if it isn't, some of this kind of history should be taught in Jamaica now. I mean, everybody needs to know about these things, but especially I think it could, I would be curious to know what the history is comprised of now. So let's go back to a little bit of the pieces of the past. Now, I thought it was really fascinating to know that they would expect these soldiers of whatever time they were to have their own horse and their own ammunition at the time to defend the state. That doesn't even make sense to me. Anyway, let's talk about 1914. On August 5th in 1914, England declared war on Germany, not long after the assassination of the hero of whoever. But this time, however, submarines and tanks were dreadnoughting and dreadnoughts, and whatever that was, it seemed like some underwater thing, appeared on the world stage, ushering in a new stage of warfare. There was never any doubt that Jamaica would show solidarity with the rest of the empire, as the governor then was Sir William Manning, said to in an August 13th meeting of the Legislative Council, "I feel that Jamaica will loyally and patriotically assume her part in maintaining the integrity of our empire and will comport herself gallantly today as she has done in the past. A decision to create a reserve regiment in every parish to guard against sovereign invasion was immediately taken and well received by the public. One Mr. William Wilson, unable to volunteer himself, wrote to the Gleaner on April 23, 1915, "If 99 other men will subscribe £30 each, I will give an equal amount and send 200 native-born Jamaicans to the front." Over £90 were raised and a war contingent committee formed. The target was 500 men for the first contingent. By the end of June, 748 volunteered and 442 were accepted. The government agreed to be responsible for the expenses of recruiting, training, and transporting, separation allowances, as well as disabilities, gratuities, and pensions. So, in other words, I suppose I don't know who this man was. It doesn't say what his position was at the time, because if he was unable to volunteer himself, but he subscribed £30 and gave them and sent 200 native-born Jamaicans. So he might have been a slave owner, I don't know, or a plantation owner. And I'm always making up my own little stories about things when I read this, and there's not enough description of who he was or what he did, just his name. But if he's going to give them men, I suppose he owned men, or they were working for him or something. But listen to this. Jamaican women did their part, too. They organized Flag Day fundraisers, a war relief fund, and sewed wooden garments for soldiers. In addition to the women's funds, there were others, including the Gleaner Fund and Palace Amusement Company's Palace War Fund. Thousands of pounds were collected. Over 4,000 packages of fruits, 71 bags of sugar, 49 cases of ginger, 4 casks of rum, and 2 cases of playing cards were shipped to military hospitals and distributed locally to men manning Jamaica's coastal fronts. So, you know, they had soldiers on the ground and some shipped off, I gather, from this. But, you see, people were very generous with their gifts and time. You know, whether they were planters, I suppose, ex-slaves or so, that's another thing that I know most people are really needing to think about. What can you give back? What can you do for your community, your family, another family? When we look back in history, there were always groups of people, you know, whether they were poor, in the middle, rich, there were always people, individuals, who felt compassion for something or someone and gave of themselves. And, you know, they say that, well, we know that so much joy comes from giving, whether you're giving your time or you're giving your money, or you're contributing to something in some way. So I always try to encourage people to do something like that in their lives. When we look back in history, there's always people doing that for a cause. And now there's so many people, so many tragedies all over the world. Sometimes we have a lot to give, but whatever you can, if you give it from the heart, that's all that matters. And sometimes it doesn't have to be money. It can be something else. I can see here that the people who didn't have money sold something. They did something. You know, that could be useful for whatever the cause was. Well, you know, even now for the people in the United States, there's always people asking to do something for the soldiers who are serving, or some of the survivors from some tragedy all over the world. Or it could be somebody in your neighborhood, you know, some cause in your town or city, no matter where you live, whether it's the United States, Jamaica, any part of the world. Humans, as humans, we share so much. And, you know, no matter what color of our skin or what language we talk, or what culture we're from, basically, we're just humans. And we can take a minute to say to ourselves, you know, what can I give? What can I give? Sometimes it's just a good word, a smile, you know, encouraging, especially a young person. I'm here advocating for the seniors not to give up on the young folks, no matter how you think they're not listening. You know what I mean? Give them some encouragement. Do something for them. Give them some pointers. Be there to support them when you can, because we can't write them off. And that's what we can leave. That's part of the legacy we can leave. I am just doing it here in the backyard because I want to really encourage my fellow seniors, because for you, for the newcomers to the site or to the Labrish, you might not know, I keep beating on it, but I'm a senior's senior. I love to say I'm a senior's senior, because a lot of seniors who are in my age group are not bothering with what I am doing. But I get so much joy from doing this research and finding out all these neat things about Jamaica and Jamaicans, and people who contributed to different things and continue to do so. I mean, I'm just like a kid in a candy store. It brings me so much joy. And so I hope that my listeners will or have enjoyed our little chat. I am always coming, I'm trying to come up with interesting things that we didn't know before, that we can be proud of. You know, there's a lot of negative things happening all over the world, and lots of news reports are always going on about that and people chatting to each other about it. But here in the backyard, I just like to celebrate happy things and good things. And sometimes even in a sad story, we can find some good. Because we know, you know, a lot of people are familiar with what happened during the days when we were enslaved and all of that. But I try to find the good points that came out of whatever the horror was. So I hope you have enjoyed my little chat. We have been on over an hour already. And I hope you will come back again. Let me see if there were any other highlights about these wars that we were always, as I see it here, involved in. But I don't know if any of my listeners remember. But I remember when I was growing up, it must be the Second World War. I don't know which one it is. But I remember hearing the planes go over, and you couldn't have any lights on. Somebody in the neighborhood would come knock on your door and tell you turn out the light. And I was scared of the dark. And my mother used to try to get a lamp or something and put someplace, and you know that they would see that somehow and knock on the door and tell you to put it out. So those are the memories I have of growing up during the war days when things were rationed. You had a book that you had to use to get your milk or whatever was imported to the island. Because in those days, we didn't manufacture what is being manufactured there at that time. So everything had to come in by ship. So they would torpedo the boats at sea, I suppose, if you're at war. So things were not coming in as often, or they were using the ships to do other things as they did before. So the authorities had to make sure that there was enough for everybody on a fair basis. So you would have this book that would tell you how many cans of milk you can get, how much sugar you can get, how much everything that was brought in. I don't remember the items because I was fairly young. But I do remember the planes going over. I remember passing up a camp. That's before I worked there, of course. And seeing there were prisoners of war there at the time. And I remember passing and seeing them, like, working without their shirts. You know, they would have them doing stuff. And there would be these Germans in their just khaki pants, or I don't remember, but they would be the top. They had no shirts on because I'm sure they were not accustomed to the hot weather like we were. But I remember how scary it was for children. I suppose the adults were scared too. But it was some experience. But at that time, I had no knowledge, and I never learned about all of this information, or most of this information that I shared with you tonight. I never knew it when I was in Jamaica, and I have just been discovering. And there's lots more to discover between Dr. Joy Lumsden and Pieces of the Past and the Encyclopedia of Jamaican Heritage. There is just so much rich information to share. And periodically we have people on that are doing something special for Jamaica, or have written a book, or is a Jamaican with a particular talent or skill or idea that we feature. So I do hope that you enjoy our shows, that you will share it with your friends, and that you will cause us to go. We're having quite a few hits. I think people are just curious to know what a labrish is, and so they'll come by and listen to the shows. But I do need, if you are listening online, there, I think there's a little box that you can pick out your favorite show or make comments on the show, and I would encourage you to do so. Because, you know, it also encourages me, and I'll know that I see people on the board, but nobody's putting up their hand. So I want to know that I appreciate you coming by, to especially the Skypers. I see them all the time. I don't know where they're Skyping in from, but I really thank you for being supportive, and just ask you to keep spreading the word. And as we say in Jamaica, come often, walk good is what we say, right? Let me just end by reading some wartime notes for you. It says here the 1st West Indian Regiment was formed in 1795 in the Windward Islands. It was a collection of Jamaicans at the time. And in 1892, Lance Corporal, late Sergeant William James Gordon of the 1st Battalion, the West Indian Regiment, received Britain's highest and very rarely awarded gallantry decoration, the Victoria Cross, which was established in 1856. He received it for saving the life of his commanding officer. Gordon is the only Jamaican to win the VC and only the second non-white to receive it. Gordon died in 1922 and is buried at Upper Camp. Our next tidbit is at the outbreak of the First World War in August of 1914, the British War Office resisted acting on the numerous requests for men of the West Indies and other colonies to join up. It was not until a year later, in 1915, when the casualties of trench warfare led to a shortage of soldiers that the War Office began to recruit heavily in the West Indies. It had been previously thought that guns and ammunition in the hands of black men would be a major mistake. Now, here's a piece of ancient mosaic let into the floor of the garrison church at the Upper Camp is a reminder of the service of Jamaica in the Holy Land during the First World War. It is from a piece of a mosaic unearthed by the firing of a Turkish shell at a British entrenchment at Andunk, a few miles from Jericho. So it's very, I didn't even know that. There's a very historic stone in the church at Upper Camp. So some of those of you that might be listening from Jamaica, I don't know if you're familiar with that. And if the church is still there, it says here, the Garrison Church has a piece of that stone. The Military Museum at Upper Camp is open from Monday to Friday. And you can call for more information. There's a Jamaica. If you're in Jamaica, there's a number you can call for more information on the museum. Now, in the vestibule of the Institute of Jamaica is a small war collection of portraits of commissioned officers who fell and objects connected with the various fronts. Norman Mashner Manley was a decorated sergeant in World War I. I don't know if all the Jamaicans know about that. His brother Douglas died in service. Norman Manley would wear a black tie in memory of his brother for the rest of his life. Huh, I didn't know that either. The distinctive Zouave uniform worn by the West Indian regiments were first issued in 1858. In a review of French colonial troops, and instructed that it would be introduced into her army. Who? And that sort of... Oh, Victoria, I'm sorry. I skipped a line. So let me recap this. You know, this old lady's eyes is not too good sometimes. The distinctive Zouave uniform worn by the West Indian regiments was first issued in 1858, original, in a review of French colonial troops, and instructed that it be introduced into her army. Don't make sense to me. Oh, Queen Victoria did that. An adaptation of this became the full dress uniform of the West Indian Regiment until the last of the regiment was disbanded in 1926 for reasons of economy. The Jamaican Military Band, which descends from the Jamaica Militia of 1662, and the band of the old battalion of the West Indian Regiment still wears it today. And that's a beautiful uniform. I remember as a child, or as a young person in Jamaica, they would play at a park camp in the gazebo. And the uniform, I don't know if they're still wearing it, was so spectacular. That headband, I mean, it was, we would go every Sunday evening to the park. That was so beautiful just to hear the band. It was just wonderful, just wonderful. So that's the tidbits that I got from wartime notes, from pieces of the past. So I encourage my listeners to research Jamaica's pieces of the past. And if you don't already have a copy, get a copy of Olive Senior's Encyclopedia of Jamaican Heritage, a great book that you should have in your library for your young folks around you to get some interesting facts about Jamaican history. It's not only about history, it's about people, it's about the culture, how things originate, some things that we would really don't even know how they got started. I did a story on the Folly Mansion myth that was really, it's just a myth, and that is getting so many hits because between the Jamaican heritage and the pieces of the past and Dr. Lumsden, we just had a whole pile of information on that story. And I just find it very, very interesting. And for those that might have listened to that show, I mentioned that there was a picture posted online, which is on the website. If you visit backyardlabrish.com and click on the Blog Talk show, it will take you to where that picture is, where the family took a picture on the veranda. The house is in ruins now, of course. But the writer of the book, Portland, the Other Jamaica, sent me the name of a great-great-great-grandson who posted that picture online. So I hope to have more pictures about the Folly story if I can get in touch with him and he'd allow me to use some more pictures. So it's just interesting to find out these things and, you know, some of these sayings or myths is facts, and some of it is some facts, very little facts, and then made up stories. But we have some fabulous, very interesting shows that are archived, and I encourage you to go check them out. We did Discover Jamaica One Parish at a Time, where we talked about each individual parishes, all 14 of them, and they all have their own unique story. So go check that out. We did shows on the exotic fruits of Jamaica. And not only did we do the fruits we know, but we discovered some things that I didn't know. Our island people might not be doing things with the bark, the seed, the leaves. We just eat the fruits. So I encourage you to check out those shows too. So there's lots of rich information. And always remember, for the people who are not very techie, I say to them, I'm not very techie either, but you can click on the show and then minimize it and listen while you check your email, you know, or just fool around your office or wherever you go to your inbox. So it's a cool way to learn some new things about, you know, Jamaica and the culture. And some people, I know a lot of people want to know, but they don't have time to go do the research and read, and especially the seniors, reading might take a little longer. So just listen to me babble about it might be easier for you to discover and learn. So with that said, I'm going to thank you so much for being my guest, whether you're listening online, on your computer, or you called in. I thank you for being here, and I hope to see you next week when the Labrish will be just as rich. We're either always going to be celebrating, enlightening, and hopefully preserving the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. So with that, I am going to bid you good night, and thanks again for coming by. This is Margaret checking out. Bye.